Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. The queens of Lord Sri Krishna rejoiced within their minds to see their husband home after a long period abroad. The queens got up at once from their seats and meditations. As was socially customary, they covered their faces shyly and looked about coyly. Please repeat. The queens of Lord Sri Krishna rejoiced within their minds.
The queens of Lord Sri Krishna rejoiced within their minds.
To see their husband home after a long period abroad.
To see their husband home after a long period abroad.
The queens got up at once from their seats and meditations. As was socially customary.
As was socially customary.
They covered their faces shyly and looked about coyly.
They covered their faces shyly and looked about coyly.
If I could interrupt just for a moment. First of all, I wanted to very much welcome back Dineshwar Prabhu, who has been gone from us for a long time, too long.
Hare Krishna.
Thank you, Prabhu, for giving class this morning. For anybody that came in late, in case you missed it, we're on Canto 1, Chapter 11, Verse 31, just about to read the purport. So we need everybody to please mute themselves. And Dineshwar, you had to give me just about 2 seconds here to switch over.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay, ready? Purport. As mentioned above, the Lord entered his palace, his home palaces, occupied by 16,108 queens. This means that the Lord at once expanded himself in his many plenary expansions, as there were queens and palaces, and entered into each and every one of them simultaneously and separately. Here is another manifestation of the feature of his internal potency. He can expand himself in as many forms of spiritual identity as he desires, even though he of the Absolute, but is confirmed by the Shruti Mantra, that the Absolute is one alone, and yet he becomes many as soon as he so desires. Those manifold expansions of the Supreme Lord are manifested as plenary and separated portions. Just a footnote here, this word plenary is not commonly used in the English language, so I just want to give the definition, that plenary means complete. So plenary expansion means a complete expansion of the Lord. Back to the purport. The separated portions are representations of his energy, and the plenary portions are manifestations of his personality. Thus, the personality of Godhead manifested himself in 16,108 plenary expansions and simultaneously entered into each and every one of the palaces of the queens. This is called Vaibhava, or the transcendental potency of the Lord. And because he can do so, he is also known as Yageshwara. Ordinarily, a yogi or mystic living being is able to expand himself at utmost to tenfold expansions of his body, but the Lord can do so to the extent of as many thousands or infinitely as he likes. Unbelievers become astonished to learn that Lord Krishna married more than 16,000 queens because they think of Lord Krishna as one of them and measure the potency of the Lord by their own limited potency. One should know, therefore, that the Lord is never on the level of the living beings, who are but expansions of his marginal potency, and one should never equalize the potent and the potency, although there is very little difference of quality between the potent and the potency. The queens were also expansions of his internal potency, and thus the potent and potencies are perpetually engaging transcendental pleasures known as the pastimes of the Lord. One should not, therefore, become astonished to learn that the Lord married so many wives. On the contrary, one should affirm that even if the Lord marries 16,000 million wives, he is not completely manifesting his unlimited and inexhaustible potency. He married only 16,000 wives and entered into each and every one of the different palaces just to impress in the history of human beings on the surface of the earth that the Lord is never equal to or less than any human being, however powerful he may be. No one, therefore, is equal to or greater than the Lord. The Lord is always great in all respects. God is great is the eternal truth. Therefore, as soon as the queens saw from a distance their husband, who was away from home for long periods due to the Battle of Kurukshetra, they all arose from the slumber of meditation and prepared to receive their most beloved. According to Yajnavalkya's religious injunctions, a woman whose husband is away from home should not take part in any social functions, should not decorate her body, should not laugh, and should not go to any relative's house in any circumstance. This is the vow of the ladies whose husbands are away from home. At the same time, it is also enjoined that a wife should never present herself before the husband in an unclean state. She must decorate herself with ornaments and good dress and should always be present before the husband in a happy and joyous mood. The queens of Lord Krishna were all in meditation, thinking of the Lord's absence, and were always meditating upon him. The Lord's devotees cannot live for a moment without meditating on the Lord, and what to speak of the queens, who were all goddesses of fortune, incarnated as queens in the pastimes of the Lord at Dwarka. They can never be separated from the Lord, either by the presence or by trance. The gopis at Vrindavan could not forget the Lord when the Lord was away in the forest cowherding. When the Lord boy Krishna was absent from the village, the gopis at home used to worry about him traversing the rough ground with his soft lotus feet. By thinking thus, they were sometimes overwhelmed in trance and mortified in the heart. Such is the condition of the pure associates of the Lord. They are always in trance. And so the queens also were in trance during the absence of the Lord. Presently, having seen the Lord from a distance, they at once got up from their engagements, including the vows of women as described above. According to Sri Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, there was a regular psychological reaction on the occasion. First of all, rising from their seats, although they wanted to see their husband, they were deterred because of feminine shyness. But due to strong ecstasy, they overcame that stage of weakness and became caught up with the idea of embracing the Lord. And this thought factually made them unconscious of their surrounding environment. This prime state of ecstasy annihilated all other formalities and social conventions, and thus they escaped all the stumbling blocks on the path of meeting the Lord. And that is the perfect stage of meeting the Lord of the soul, Sri Krishna. Omaganatmanandasya gananjana shalaka chakshin militamina tasmai shri gurave namaha shri chaitanya manovistam sapitam yena bhutale svayamupagadamayam dadati svapadantikam. So I'm happy again to be able to participate in the class on Skype with all the devotees around the world. I have another several weeks here in America before I return to Ukraine. So I'll be happy to participate as much as possible. In this chapter, we're hearing about the reception of the Lord, how the Lord is received by the citizens of Dwarka on his return from the Battle of Kurukshetra. And what we're learning here in this chapter is the Vedic culture or the Brahminical culture. Culture means the relationships between people and the behavior of people. And in this regard, we learn from the Srimad Bhagavatam in the fourth canto that these lessons are for our eternal benefit. From 4:18, verses 3 to 5, it states, to benefit all human society, not only in this life but in the next. The great seers and sages have prescribed various methods conducive to the prosperity of the people in general. One who follows the principles and instructions enjoined by the great sages of the past can utilize these instructions for practical purposes. Such a person can very easily enjoy life and pleasures. A foolish person who manufactures his own ways and means through mental speculation and does not recognize the authority of the sages who lay down unimpeachable directions is simply unsuccessful again and again in his attempts. So the point is that we are learning culture. Practically, we can say that at the present time in the Kali Yuga, the world is devoid of culture, practically all culture, what to speak of a spiritual culture. So in the Bhagavatam and in the Dharma Shastras, we learn the proper behavior of human beings, not only by instructions of the sages, but then also we read the activities of the people, of the devotees of the Lord, and we see how they practice those instructions as well. The idea is that we are meant to imbibe those behaviors, those practices, and as followers of Srila Prabhupada, to create the spiritual culture which demonstrates all of these things. Again, because the sages have given this to us as a way to live, and if we live that way, we can actually be happy, and as this verse says, easily enjoy life and life's pleasures, without becoming contaminated by material attraction and attachment. So a very important part of the culture is how we receive guests. There's many lessons in the Bhagavatam of how different persons are received well or how they are not received well, and there's lessons to be learned from them. The reason for receiving the guests nicely is to make them, of course, feel happy, to feel welcome, to feel comfortable, and to establish the relationship between them and all of the other parties present. We spoke about this, I think maybe it was our first opportunity to speak to the assembled devotees from Hawaii, about the place, the importance of a place in culture, or we can use the Sanskrit word chaitra. That chaitra means place, and in society everyone must have their place. In a proper culture, the place gives every person a way to relate to others and to the world, and from that place they're able then to make progress, to grow spiritually. Without having a sense of place, we don't know how to, practically speaking, we don't know what to do or how to do in such a way so that we can, be progressive in our activities. So therefore, the lessons are given again and again and again. For example, the Bhagavatam begins with the story of Parikshit, and Parikshit not being received properly by the sage. The story is Parikshit was out touring his kingdom. He became thirsty, went to the hermitage of a sage, and the sage, being in trance, was neglecting him, did not receive him properly, did not speak to him, did not offer him a seat or some water. And Parikshit, being fatigued, became offended and garlanded the sage with a snake, and as a reaction was cursed by the sage's son. So this is one example of an improper reception. Another one is reception of Sati, Lord Shiva's wife. Daksha, her father, was performing a sacrifice, did not invite Lord Shiva, or his wife, or rather did not invite Shiva and Shiva's wife Sati, or Daksha's daughter. And Sati, being unhappy, she begged her husband, "Please let me go. I want to see my family relatives." Lord Shiva told her, "This will not be good. You should not go." But she desisted. She did not follow the instructions of her husband, went anyway. She was not received by her, by any of the other guests except her mother and sisters. And being offended by the behavior of her father and the other guest, she committed what is now known as sati. She sat down in trance and gave up her body because that body was associated with Daksha. And then another instance of not being received properly is Lord Balaram, who was not participating at the Battle of Kurukshetra. Instead, he went on tour to places of pilgrimage, came to one place where a group of sages were assembled. The main speaker was Ramaharshan Sutta, who, being seated on the Vyasasan as the person leading the assembly, did not stand up to receive Balaram. Typically, that would be perhaps the proper etiquette with any other person, but because Balaram is himself the Supreme Personality of Godhead, this was offensive on the part of Ramaharshan. So in order to instruct the sages there how to properly receive the Supreme Lord, Balaram picked up a piece of grass and simply by touching Ramaharshan with this piece of grass caused him to leave his body. So there's various examples like this of when personalities are not received properly and the reactions that are incurred by doing so. At the same time, we also have many instructions about how to receive saintly personality. One of those, for example, is Pitu receiving the four Kumaras. That story from the from the fourth canto. No. Okay, I didn't do that. When the Kumaras were Prithu was actually being worshipped in an assembly, and the four Kumaras came to that assembly, and even though Prithu was himself the honorary guest, he himself got up from his seat and he received the four Kumaras very properly. And let me see if I can find this. I thought I made a note of that. Yes, here. This is from the fourth canto. This is from the 22nd chapter. The great sage Maitreya said, "While the citizens were thus praying to the most powerful King Prithu, the four Kumaras, who were as bright as the sun, arrived on the spot. Seeing the glowing effulgence of the four Kumaras, the masters of all mystic power, the king and his associates could recognize them as they descended from the sky. Seeing the four Kumaras, Prithu Maharaj was greatly anxious to receive them. Therefore the king, with all of his officers, very hastily got up, as eagerly as a conditioned soul whose senses are immediately attracted by the modes of material nature. When the great sages accepted their reception, according to the instructions of Shastra, and finally took their seats offered by the king, influenced by the glories of the sages, immediately bowed down and worshipped the four Kumaras. After this, the king sprinkled the water which had washed the lotus feet of the Kumaras. The king took the water which had washed the lotus feet of the Kumaras and sprinkled it over his hair. By such a respectful action, as an exemplary personality, he showed how to receive a spiritually advanced personality." And then we can also learned from the reception of Dhruva. You remember Dhruva, as a young child, became insulted by his father and was told by his stepmother that in order to sit on his father's lap, he would have to take birth again from her womb. Being insulted, he went to his mother to complain, and his mother said, "What can I do? I'm not the favored wife of your father." And so Dhruva said, "Okay, well, if you can't do anything, then who can do something? This situation has to be corrected." And his mother advised him that he should go to find God, that God is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He is in a position to actually correct his father, who was, of course, the administrator of the entire universe at the time. So Dhruva asked his mother, "Where do I find God?" She said, "In the forest. The sages say to find God in the forest." And Dhruva went to the forest and with great determination set out to find God. Even though he was just a young boy, he had a great Kshatriya spirit and was undeterred in this quest. So gradually, in the course of time, he came across Narada Muni, who advised him to go home. But Dhruva, he persisted that, "Okay, if you can't show me how to find God, then never mind, I'll find someone else who can." So Narada, being impressed by the determination of this child, he gave them instruction how he could actually come face to face with the Supreme Lord. So he initiated him there, gave him his spiritual instruction, and with great determination, Dhruva was able to accomplish that feat, and after a few months' period of time, came face to face with Lord Narayan. After that meeting, then Dhruva returned to his house. And when his father heard that he was coming back, he didn't believe it. He thought, "My son is gone for so many months. He's just a five-year-old child. How can he be returning?" But then the rumor was confirmed, and King Uttanapada, became very eager to see his son. So let me read here again from the fourth canto of the Bhagavatam. This is the ninth chapter. "Then King Uttanapada, being very eager to see the face of his lost son, mounted a chariot drawn by excellent horses and bedecked with golden filigree, taking with him many learned brahmanas, all the elderly personalities of his family, his officers, his ministers, and his immediate friends. He immediately left the city. As he proceeded in this parade, there were auspicious sounds of conch shells, kettle drums, flutes, and the chanting of Vedic mantras to indicate all good fortune. Both the queens of King Uttanapada, namely Suniti and Suruchi, along with their other son, Uttama, appeared in the procession. The queens were seated on a palanquin. Upon seeing Dhruva Maharaj approaching the neighboring small forest, King Uttanapada with great haste got down from his chariot. He had been anxious for a long time to see his son, and therefore with great love and affection he went forward to embrace his lost boy. Breathing very heavily, the king embraced him with both arms. But Dhruva Maharaj was not the same as before. He was completely sanctified by the spiritual advancement due to having been touched by the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Reunion with Dhruva Maharaj fulfilled King Uttanapada's long-cherished desire, and for this reason he smelled Dhruva's head again and again and bathed him with torrents of very cold tears. Then Dhruva Maharaj, the foremost of all nobles, first of all offered his obeisances at the feet of his father and was honored by his father with various questions. He then bowed his head at the feet of his two mothers. Suruchi, the younger mother of Dhruva Maharaj, seeing that the innocent boy had fallen at her feet, immediately picked him up, embracing him with her hands, and with tears of feeling, she blessed him with the words, "My dear boy, long may you live." Unto one whose transcendental qualities due to friendly behavior with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, all living entities offer honor, just as water automatically flows down by nature. The two brothers, Uttama and Dhruva Maharaj also exchanged their tears. They were overwhelmed by the ecstasy of love and affection, and when they embraced one another, the hair on their bodies stood up. Suniti, the real mother of Dhruva Maharaj, embraced the tender body of her son, who was dearer than her own life, and thus forgot all material grief, for she was very pleased. So in all of these meetings and greetings, we see the proper exchange, that first there's obeisances paid to the respectable party, the seniors, the either the parents or the spiritual master, or the spiritually advanced personalities. Then meeting is made with equals, and then blessings are given to the juniors. So this culture we have to learn. We see in our ISKCON, we have to some degree imbibed this culture. Of course, I can't say specifically how widespread it is, because ISKCON is so large. But we see that when, say, one of ISKCON's gurus or sannyasis may come, or a senior devotee, that the other devotees, they come out, they assemble, they come to greet him or her, and generally chanting the Maha Mantra, offering of a garland and some praise. And it's expected that the senior, the person who is being received, must also reciprocate the greeting of all the devotees. And in this story of the greeting of Lord Sri Krishna, we learn how Krishna himself, he reciprocated the greetings of all the inhabitants of Dwarka, even down to the, let's say, most common person there, that the Lord properly reciprocated with him. So we want to imbibe this culture. We want to learn and imbibe this culture. Now, let me go to the second part, the second paragraph of the purport, and comment just a bit about from there. There we hear how the queens received their husband, Lord Sri Krishna, and how they were following the religious injunctions, also called Stri Dharma. In this case, Prabhupada is quoting from or referring to Yajnavalkya's religious injunctions, explaining the duty of a woman whose husband is away from home. Now, of course, this is very, very different from the behavior, the so-called culture that we have today. Yajnavalkya is explaining that a woman whose husband is away from home, she should not decorate her body, she should not go to social functions, she should not go to any relative's house, indeed, she should not even laugh. So the idea here is that a chaste wife, that she is completely dedicated to her husband, and she keeps herself protected by restricting her association with others in the absence of her husband. Here we can actually take some more lessons from the Bhagavatam. In the seventh canto, also refers to the duty of the wife from 7:11:25, to render service to the husband, to always be favorably disposed toward the husband, to be equally well disposed toward the husband's relative friends, and to follow the vows of the husband. These are the four principles to be followed by a woman described as chaste. A chaste woman should not be greedy, but should be satisfied in all circumstances. She may be very expert in handling household affairs, or must be very expert in handling household affairs, and should be fully conversant with religious principles. She should speak pleasingly and truthfully, and should be very careful and always clean and pure. Thus, a chaste woman should engage with affection in the service of her husband, who is not fallen. By this behavior, the women actually protect the culture. Complaint was made by Arjuna to Lord Sri Krishna in the first chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna, Arjuna rather, was giving reasons why he should not fight in the battle, and they're mentioning that if the men are killed, that these ladies will be unprotected, and if they are unprotected, then unwanted progeny will come. The idea is that women, generally as a class, are simple, are easily, can be easily, flattered. Can be easily flattered and seduced. And therefore, Arjuna was saying that, you know, these men, they have to be there to protect their wives, otherwise the whole culture will be spoiled. Now, in general, this is true, but in terms of the Vaishnava ladies, we actually see that the Vaishnava ladies, that they are as important for not only protecting the culture, but establishing, re-establishing the spiritual culture, as much so as the men. Because in general, the women, they arrange the social calendar, they are becoming very prominent in society, especially at this time. Somehow or other, I don't know what it is, maybe the astrological influence or something, but we see that the women are actually becoming more and more prominent, more and more powerful, even more so than men. There was a program on the radio that I happened to hear the other day. It was a description of the benefits of the people in this country of Sweden, and how the men, they get, if there's a child born, they have many days, at least 2 months maternity leave also from their jobs, so that they can spend time with their new children. And then that program was describing that in this situation, for this one family, the woman is working and the husband was staying home and actually taking care of the children. And this is not uncommon today, that we see this, particularly in after this economic debacle of several years ago. Oftentimes we find that the women, that they earn more than their husbands, and so on the basis of economics, it's decided that the woman will stay at work and the husband will stay home and maintain the children, or take care of the children. Not an uncommon situation today. So the point is that the ladies, they become more and more prominent in society, and therefore, my point is that the ladies, they actually, the Vaishnava ladies, they have a opportunity. And a duty to see to it that the culture is properly followed and to help establish the culture. We see, for example, in this verse, just continuing there again a little later on, that when the husband, that it is enjoined that a wife should never present her before her husband in an unclean state. She must decorate herself with ornaments and good dress and always be present before the husband in a happy and joyous mood. And practically speaking, it's just the opposite of this today, because women, you know, when they're around the house, they relax. They don't, you know, make themselves perhaps very beautiful, but when they get ready to leave the house, that's when they'll put on their makeup or do their hair, dress themselves nicely, and so on. And so we see the situation that when the woman is home, she's not looking in a beautiful state, but she's looking in a beautiful state for who? For all the other people in society. And the same thing for the husband. He's at home. He doesn't see his wife in a beautiful state, but rather he may go to work or go out, and he sees all the women then decorated very nicely and more attractive, perhaps, than his wife, who he sees at home. Of course, this is all due to the degraded influence of the age. But the point that I want to make here is that the Dharma Shastra, they give us specific instructions, how if we follow them, we can be happy and make regular progress in spiritual life. So the women, it's they have an unprecedented opportunity at the present time to influence the culture, to actually help to remold, to remake the culture, to rebuild proper culture in society. So, let's see. What time do we have to stop?
If you want to keep on going.
I want to leave some time for questions, but let's say quarter to the hour. Can we have that much more time?
Oh, generally by 8:30, that's when we stop.
Until
the next 10 minutes, something like that, that's when we stop and come to questions.
All right, then I'll stop speaking here, and then we can have discussion or questions.
Okay, hold on. I'm sorry. You just got to let me unmute on the other side.
Okay.
That's pre-conferencing. Okay, Peru, so if there's any questions or comments, otherwise, please remain muted so there's not a whole lot of background noise. I can ask a question.
Sure.
You, of course, in the purport, Srila Prabhupada is talking about the character of these exalted devotees of the Lord who are seeing the real husband, the personality of Godhead. But still there is reference to how in ordinary dealings, just like you're referring to the Varnashram society, how women should act according to their husband, in relation to their husband, properly. You don't find so much instruction for the men. It would seem to me that there's more emphasis on how the woman should act in relationship with the husband than so much for the men. There is a little bit of reference, for instance, if you want to make the wife happy, then you should supply ornaments and clothing and children, and then they'll be happy. Although in my own experience, what I've seen in modern society is that's like a drop in the bucket compared to, especially if you have children, then boy, that's just the beginning of what you're going to need to support. My own speculation is this, and you just tell me your comment on it, is that actually the point is that for the husband to please the wife, what he really needs to do is advance in spiritual life. And then if the wife sees him advancing spiritually, if she is of good character, then that will satisfy her, as long as she has sufficient of those other, necessities, clothing, raiment, and everything needed for the children.
Okay. The Bhagavatam is written from the male perspective, and therefore, in modern terms, it seems like a sexist document, but it is written for, basically speaking, for the men. And the man, he devotes himself to God, and the woman, she assists her husband, and together they both go back to Godhead. Therefore, there's no explicit, it may not seem like explicit instructions for the man as there are for the women. Although the instructions are there in some of the Dharma Shastras, if you read them, it does give the instructions for the men. It will give them in terms of, according to Varna, these instructions for Varna refer basically to the men. But because the Shastra is written in, from the male perspective, then specific or, let's say, explicit instructions must be given for the ladies so that they know this is for them specifically. And so that distinction will be seen. Now, at the same time, or rather, so that's perhaps why why you're not seeing the same kind of explicit instructions for men. Does that make sense to you?
Okay.
I don't know if you're referring to specifically instructions for men in relationship to their wives or just in general.
It seems like the emphasis is always on developing the chastity of the ladies in relationship to their husbands. But the other way around, I don't see it so much.
Yeah, this is it's very significant because of the male-female psychology. If we go to, one second here, let me try to find this. The story about Maharaj Priyavrata. This is one second. Okay, this is there it is. Fifth canto, first chapter, 29th verse. This is about Maharaj Priyavrata. And 29th shloka. Maharaj Priyavrata ruled the universe. Wherever he was determined to fix his arrow upon his bowstring with his two powerful arms, all opponents of the regulative principles would flee due to his unprecedented prowess. He greatly loved his wife, Barismati, and with the increase of days, their exchange of nuptial love also increased. By her feminine behavior, as she dressed herself, walked, got up, smiled, laughed, and glanced about, Queen Barismati increased his energy. Thus, although he was a great soul, he appeared lost in the feminine conduct of his wife. He appeared with her just like an ordinary man, but actually he was a great soul. In the commentary, Prabhupada explains that it says, for a brahmana or a sannyasi, brahmanas and sannyasis do not need encouragement from the opposite sex, but all the other sections of society, the men do need encouragement from the opposite sex. So therefore, in order for the man to pursue his duty, both materially and spiritually, he needs the support and encouragement of his wife. And so therefore we hear about the instructions of the wife to support her husband. And if this is done, then the natural psychology of both the man and the woman will be satisfied and progress will be realized. But this principle practically is almost forgotten today. And therefore, you know, the modern idea is that men and women are equal, in the effort to try to compensate for the influence of tamagun, where men have been lording it over and exploiting their wives or women in general. Therefore, the modern idea is that, well, we'll solve this problem by making women equal to men. But it can't be done because women and men are not equal. Rather, the situation is solved by bringing everybody to the standard of sattva-gun, where the man behaves in his natural capacity as the protector and the provider for his family, and the woman, she acts in her natural capacity as the nurturer of the family. And with both the man and the wife doing their proper duty, the sexual psychology of both of them is satisfied. So, sorry, I lost the point. What was your point?
Sorry, I was muted. No, I think you addressed it. I just
So because it's referring always to the women, what the women should do, and the point is that these instructions are extremely important for the women. The women, you know, previously they were not meant that they were going to follow, try to understand religious principle, or let's say not put it that way, not to worship God directly. They accepted their husbands as practically the Lord, and by serving Him together, then they would both make spiritual advancement and realize spiritual perfection. So that's why we see these instructions like this specifically for the women to serve and serve their husbands and to satisfy them in these various ways.
Actually, I liked your answer, Prabhu. I liked how you answered Ramananda's question right from the beginning. I found it very satisfying. That, I mean, it is, in fact, the scriptures are written more sort of to the male or from a male perspective. And how the woman, by serving the husband, she gets all the benefit. And Prabhupada says he goes back to Godhead, she goes back to Godhead just by serving him. Now, of course, you know, we have to be a little bit culturally sensitive. I mean, we've moved well into the age of Kali, and we don't always see the male setting the best example. But at least from an ideal perspective, I mean, what you said is absolutely correct. And I liked your answer. I was going to add I liked also you were giving so many nice examples of receiving guests and how proper that is. I just wanted to add something, if that was okay. And this is from the Krishna book, where Krishna set the example himself by receiving his dear friend Sudama Brahman. This is only one relatively short paragraph. At that time, Lord Krishna was sitting on his bedstead of Queen Rukmini. Even from a considerable distance, he could see the Brahmana coming to his home, and he could recognize him as his friend. Lord Krishna immediately left his seat and came forward to receive his Brahmana friend, and upon reaching him, embraced the Brahmana with his two hands. Lord Krishna is a reservoir of transcendental pleasure, yet he himself felt great pleasure upon embracing the poor Brahmana because he was meeting his very dear friend. Lord Krishna had him seated on his own bedstead and personally brought all kinds of fruits and drinks to offer him, as is proper in receiving a worshipable guest. Lord Krishna is the supreme pure, but because he was playing the role of an ordinary human being, he immediately washed the Brahmana's feet and for his own purification, sprinkled the water onto his head. After this, the Lord smeared the body of the Brahmana with different kinds of scented pulp, such as sandalwood, aguru, and saffron. He immediately burned several kinds of scented incense, as is usual, and offered arti with his burning lamps. After thus offering him an adequate welcome, and after the Brahman had taken food and drink, Lord Krishna said, "My dear friend, it is my great fortune that you have come here." Anyway, I thought I'd just add that.
Thanks. That's a very wonderful one. I was trying to remember so many of these examples, and I overlooked that one, but it's a very, very wonderful example. Here, Krishna is receiving the Brahmana as his equal because they were classmates. And so Krishna didn't, the protocol then was to embrace him as an equal. Thank you very much, Prabhu.
Hare Krishna, this is Carla Patti.
Hare Krishna, Mataji.
Hare Krishna. I have a question. Can you say something about Yajnavalkya?
I was looking for something for that, and I couldn't find it. You know, I've got some of the Dharma Shastras back in Russia. I don't have them. I can't travel with all that stuff. And I don't know it well enough to be able to recite it from memory.
So you don't know who he was?
No, I'm sorry. I was trying to find that, and I couldn't find anything.
Because I mean, there's so many things as Vaishnavas. I mean, like you're saying, if a woman's husband's away, does that mean she doesn't go to the temple? She doesn't go to Balaram's Appearance Day Festival or to Rath Yatra? I mean, how do you apply that in reality as a devotee of Krishna, not just somebody following Vanashram Dharma?
Yeah. There's
I don't think it applies.
Yeah, there's many things that can be said about this, and because Prabhupada he made accommodations because of the nature of the Western culture, and he allowed women to do various things because he saw that the boys and the girls they mix so freely and as equals that he couldn't apply these things that could be applied before. So the question is, what can or let's say should we do in our culture, or is there a higher standard to be aimed at? Should we aim at this, or should we try to move in that direction? And to be honest, we have to do this very much according to time, place, and circumstance. We can't just take a hard line and say, this is Sri Dharma and this is what all the women should do. I don't think it's practical. I don't think it would work. Personally, rather, we have to see how do we adjust according to time, place, and circumstance. But I would also add that we would do well to try to move in the direction of that original culture. For example, in our society of devotees, we mix still very freely between men and women. Is it a good thing? One can argue this from both sides. It is the culture, and so we do it. But on the other hand, we see that there's often divorce and remarriage. I don't know what the statistics are here, but I know that in the Russian-speaking countries, there's a very high rate of divorce, even within the first 5 years of marriage. Is that due to the free mixing of this between the men and women? Possibly.
I think it's more because they don't understand what they're getting into.
Yeah, I'm sure there's...
They don't really understand what marriage is. There's no, pre-counseling.
I'm sure there's a whole bunch of factors that are involved, and you can't just say it's this thing or it's that thing. Anyway, my basic comment is that to time, place, and circumstance. And my more general statement is that I think our ladies would do well to understand the important role that they have in actually protecting the culture. Our ladies, they read the Shastras, they know the philosophy, they're also chanting the mantra. In that sense, spiritually, there's no question that they can be equal to the men. And in that way, they can actually even take a leading role in, establishing or protecting the culture. So I encourage that. Rebuttal?
Well, I'm relating to, I don't know about a rebuttal, but Prabhupada said that if you're identifying yourself as either a male or a female, then you're limited by all those injunctions and things mentioned in the Shastras. But he says if you're not, that it's and that I would think would be a higher thing to aspire for. No, I'm not a Brahmin, I'm not a Vaishnava, I'm not a Brahmin, I'm not a Kshatriya, I'm not a Shudra, I'm not a male, I'm not a woman. I'm none of those things. I'm the eternal servant of Krishna. And that should be our meditation. That's what we're looking for, not trying to follow all these rules and regulations that aren't maybe they're leading up to that, but we're supposed to be aspiring for a higher platform. And
sure.
It's more than following these rules and regulations.
Sure. There's no argument there. But again, let me go back and read that sloka that I read just at the beginning of class. To benefit all human society, not only in this life and the next, the great sages and seers have prescribed various methods conducive to the prosperity of the people in general. One who follows his principles and instructions enjoined by the great sages of the past can utilize these instructions for practical purposes. Such a person can very easily enjoy life and pleasures. A foolish person who manufactures his own ways and means through mental speculation and does not recognize the authority of the sages who lay down unimpeachable directions is simply unsuccessful again and again in his attempts. So we can't just artificially jump to the transcendental platform. We have to understand, yes, I'm a spirit soul, I'm not a Brahman, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra, man or woman, but I have a conditioned nature, and I have to deal with that conditioned nature and not try to think that I can just overcome that, you know, because of my mental understanding. As long as the conditioned nature is there, we have to deal with it. Okay.
So if you look at this strictly by the words, does that mean, say I'm married and my husband is away and there's an activity going on in the temple that I shouldn't go?
Well, let's take the principle. Instead of look, there's the principle and the detail.
I'm trying to understand how to apply it. And,
sure.
And it's
sure.
Looking very, you know, if I follow it really strictly according to the letter, I wouldn't go.
Right.
Or if I had grandchildren that needed my help, I wouldn't go.
Mm-hmm. So let's understand the principle. The principle is that the woman, she is chaste to her husband. That she is very careful not to allow herself to get into a situation where she can be, where her chastity can be compromised. Now, apply that principle then in your own situation, because it's a different day. We, you know, to take these statements that were written 5,000 years ago, you know, they have to be adjusted to time, place, and circumstance. How does a woman today maintain that kind of chastity, or even perhaps even develop that kind of chastity? We have to work from where we are at. We can't artificially jump over that or ignore our conditioned nature. And in keeping our eye on that goal, let's say, we go in that direction. And as we make progress in spiritual life, we will find ourselves naturally more attracted to following those rules, not because it's a rule that I have to follow, but because it develops naturally in our consciousness as we become purified.
But I'm still asking the question, do I go to the temple or don't I? Is that considered a social situation, or is that considered a transcendental situation that would be beyond that?
And I'm saying you have to answer that question yourself according to the principle. You know, is your chastity going to be compromised in some way?
I'm
not going to answer that question for you.
Yeah, I should certainly hope not. If the temple is a place like that, then I would be very upset, because it shouldn't be.
You know, on the other hand, there may be some woman, you know, who's, you know, some guy at the temple's flirting with her, right? And she's going there without her husband, and she may say, well, maybe I shouldn't go this time, right? Time, place, and circumstance. I was faced with such a situation in Ukraine just before I left. This one fellow, he was coming to a nearby Namahata. Ostensibly, his reason was that he wanted to render some service to me. But I found out from the devotees at the Namahata, actually he's here because he's got his eye on this other married woman. Huh? And so she didn't come to that program specifically because he was there.
I think. Okay. Because she was aware of it.
Yeah. She's aware of it, and she doesn't want to have anything to do with him. So I thought that was, you know, I was very happy to hear of her determination and the steps that she took to protect herself and protect her marriage from this unwanted suitor.
Well, that makes sense. In that situation, I see, yeah, I'm in the circumstance. So what would be the difficulty with visiting your children? Especially if they had need for you.
Well, the way I read that is, let me look at it again.
I'm sorry to be so specific, but...
That's okay. No, that's okay. Let me just go back and read this again. It says, she should not take part in any social functions, not decorate her body, not laugh, should not go to any relative's house in any circumstance. I can't say that I understand that one completely. I'm sorry, I can't give you any reply to that. Why not to go to a relative's house? I don't know.
Because it's hard to... you obviously have to have the realization to be able to apply it.
Yeah.
And...
I take it more that that's a cultural circumstance that applied then. And we have to... You know, we have to apply it to our own cultural circumstance now. The principle...
Excuse me for interrupting.
Yeah, go ahead.
The reason Lord Shiva didn't want Sati to go to the sacrifice of Daksha was because her relatives would speak bad about him. So
right.
Maybe that
right.
has something to do with this. You know, why not
well,
to
I
go
could
to
see
relatives
it. I wouldn't go. That makes sense if there's that kind of situation going on.
Oh, okay, in terms of going to a relative's house.
Right, if there's some bad judgments about the husband or they're going to find fault because he's not there, then why would you want to go into that situation?
Yeah, this purport, Prabhupada's not speaking specifically about that circumstance. And so I take this commentary, this comment in the purport to be a more of a general application from Yajnavalkya.
I wanted to know who he was.
Yeah. He's written some of the Dharma Shastra. That's all I know about him.
We have just one other question.
Sure.
Go ahead, Prabhu.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Bo.
I want to ask a question. My husband has a child with a wife before me. And I want to know, because I don't want to go in this temple, where is the mother of the child. And I want to know if this is right or I should go in the temple. Because I can meet her and I don't want to talk with her. My husband is upset if I talk with her, if I see her. So I'm really bothered with that. And I really want to know with the Krishna consciousness perspective, what should I do?
From, let's say, from the perspective, okay. Your purpose in going to the temple would be for what? For seeing the deities, for participating in kirtan, and so on. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
So, you can see the deity in your own house.
Yes.
If you don't want to go, it's not required that you go to the temple. You have
mm-hmm.
Krishna there in your house. You can have kirtan there in your house. I don't think that it's necessary for you to have to go to that particular place to see Krishna. You can see Krishna anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
If there's some disturbing circumstance for you, then you can avoid that.
Yeah, because we have three temples here and I don't need to go in this particular temple, right?
Oh. Yeah, go to the other one then.
Yes, this is what. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Sure. Hare Krishna.
Thank you.
Now, I have a question I'd like to ask the devotees. Maybe you can help me understand this. In the last verse of the purport, Prabhupada says, due to strong ecstasy, the wives of Krishna overcame that stage of weakness and became caught up with the idea of embracing the Lord. And this thought factually made them unconscious of their surrounding environment. This prime state of ecstasy annihilated all the other formalities and social conventions, and thus they escaped all the stumbling blocks on the path of meeting the Lord. Now, my impression was that the queens of Dwarka were, let's say, inhibited, at least to some degree, by social conventions. Otherwise, these devotees, they would be eligible to enter into Madhurya Ras with the Lord. But it's the those devotees who are unable to give up the idea of social convention or are attached to, let's say, following the rules and regulations, they become the wives of Krishna and Dwarka. So how is it that Prabhupada states it like this, when it seems to me that, from my understanding, that the queens of Dwarka would be inhibited in some way by social convention? Anybody can reply to that?
I think Mother Urmila said nicely, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks ago, there was one class talking about, just in the course of the class, pointing out how the gopis in the Rasa dance, they were just so like ecstatic to go and see Krishna that they were putting the top of their saris on the bottom and they have their makeup on and stuff like that. Whereas normally a young girl, you know, like a teenager, spends hours in the bathroom to make sure everything is just perfect. But someone's in great ecstasy that they forget about all social customs and they just run to their most beloved. So it's so desirable and the devotee is so ecstatic to see him that they even forget all normal custom. But then we'll see, I think, in the next verse or so that so then they send their sons that, which is just like embracing directly.
Okay, what's that have to do with the queens and Dwarka?
So similarly, the queens and Dwarkas, naturally they're shy, but because their ecstasy is so much, they want to go and embrace the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
So they send their sons, actually.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, they send their sons.
Okay. Anything else?
Okay, Prabhu, thank you very much for giving us your association once again.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak. I hope I'm not too politically incorrect. I'm told sometimes that some of the classes I give wouldn't be possible to give in a place like New Dwarka. So I don't know if, anyway... If some of the Matajis, if you find some fault with what I said, I'd like to actually hear from you so that I can kind of, understand the current mood, what's going on. I would really appreciate the feedback, particularly from the women.
Okay, thank you very much,
Prabhu. Srila Prabhupada Ki.
Jai
Prabhupada.
Okay.